The Gone Cold podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
Since I'd stayed up till all hours the night before, frantically trying to finish an episode about the second day of the trial of Glenn Samuel McCurley, I was running late on Tuesday, August 24th, 2021, the third day of trial. My head was pounding from whatever the south wind blew up this way, and that wasn't helping any. I took some Advil and chugged down a couple cups of coffee and rushed out the door, headed for the Tim Curry Criminal Justice Center. As soon as I hit downtown Fort Worth, of course, the traffic was backed all the way up to where Highway 121 merges into Belknap Street. When I finally made it inside Tarrant County Criminal Court 1, about 5 minutes till 9, everyone was standing. The scene was a bit chaotic. Many folks were crying, comforting one another as they decompressed 47 years worth of sadness and uncertainty. Carla Walker's brother Jim was embracing Glenn McCurley's son, one of the most recent victims of this man's depraved act of physical and sexual violence. I had no idea what was happening. Was there an angry or emotional outburst in the court by the defendant, I wondered, or perhaps one of Carla's friends or family members in attendance? Within a minute of entering, I was approached by someone who asked if I saw what happened. They were late getting there too, but had got the scoop just moments before I arrived. Just after Judge Elizabeth Beach entered the court, at around 8:30 a.m., Tarrant County Criminal Assistant District Attorney Kim Davignon pulled Carla's siblings Jim and Cindy out of the courtroom. I wasn't there to see this, of course, but I can imagine the courtroom's spectators erupted into speculative whispers about what was happening. Glenn Samuel McCurley, Davignon told Cindy and Jim, had changed his plea from not guilty to guilty, waiving his right to a trial by jury. When Jim and Cindy were brought back into the courtroom, Judge Beach swore in McCurley. She held up a document and asked the defendant if the signature on it, this judicial confession, was his. Yes, McCurley replied. To the charges listed on the document, Her Honor continued, the confessed killer could plead guilty or not guilty. What is your plea? Judge Beach asked. Guilty, he replied. McCurley answered yes when asked if he was pleading guilty because he was guilty and for no other reason. Since the death penalty was taken off the table months before the trial began, Judge Elizabeth Beach sentenced 78-year-old Glenn Samuel McCurley to life in prison. That was it. The trial was over after 2 days of state witness testimony. After 47 years, justice for Carla Walker was finally realized. The trial of Glenn Samuel McCurley ended a little before 9 a.m. on Tuesday, August 24th, 2021, but the day was hardly over. Perhaps the most emotionally impactful moments of this entire process happened after the plea change and sentencing, in the form of Cindy and Jim Walker's allocations. Both were more powerful than I could have ever imagined, and I couldn't help but feel like I got to know Carla's parents a little more as their two surviving children spoke to McCurley with strength and stoicism, two of the qualities that made Charlene and Leighton Walker such admirable folks, Jim and Cindy told me years ago, even if those qualities were used at times to hide their pain from the outside world. But before we discuss Jim and Cindy's allocations, I'd like to get into what the rest of the trial would have looked like had Glenn Samuel McCurley not changed his plea. The events of this third day of trial happened abruptly, and seemingly everyone in the courtroom was surprised, perhaps in a state of shock. It didn't seem real to me. In fact, 2 weeks later as I write this, it's only just now setting in, and I know why. McCurley's confession was, as you've heard me say so many times, bullshit, full of lies and omissions. It leaves the same 47-year-old questions still unanswered. We still don't know exactly what happened, and I'm not sure we will anytime soon. To help answer questions of another nature, though, we spoke with Assistant Criminal District Attorney Emily Dixon. The first state's witness that day would have been Andrew Greenstein, the KRLD newsman who took Glenn Samuel McCurley's jailhouse interview.
So we had a couple more witnesses. One of them, at this point, it may not even be a surprise to anyone, but a couple, a day or so after he spoke with Detective Wagner and Detective Bennett, he also spoke to KRLD from the jail. So that interview was relatively brief, but it was consistent with what he had told Detective Wagner and Bennett. And so we were going to, play that as well.
As Emily said, the fact that Greenstein was going to testify was not a surprise. And if you've been keeping up with Carla's case since McCurley's arrest, you were likely familiar with the newsman's jailhouse interview. It's much like the confession McCurley gave detectives the day of his arrest, the one that has him saving Carla from an abusive situation. The same lies. After KRLD's Andrew Greenstein, Tarrant County Deputy Medical Examiner Dr. Tasha Greenberg was set to take the stand.
We had a witness. Obviously, we didn't have Dr. Gwotes himself. He's since passed away. But there's a medical examiner here in Tarrant County who is going to testify for us. She was not present for the autopsy, but she is an expert in medical pathology type evidence, and she was going to explain some of those things to the jury. What I can say, she didn't catch anything that would be a detail in the autopsy that other people hadn't caught. She was going to have to testify more generally. There are some legal implications to just putting we couldn't put the autopsy report into evidence because she personally was not the one who did it. What she was able to do was talk about the observations that were made during the autopsy and then her impressions and conclusions as an expert on her own that she could draw from that autopsy observations, right? And so there were some things that, as far as medical science is concerned now and how it's changed, that she actually felt a little bit differently on. Some conclusions that were made back then that she feels like, we really can't say that as a definitive conclusion now. I can say it's consistent with this observation, but I can't just definitively say, what it is. And as an example, she, in a joint meeting with, us and the defense in preparation for trial, she said, what sexual assault comes down to is consent. And as a medical doctor, I wasn't there. I can't say definitively that someone consented or didn't consent. What I can tell you is there were bruises, et cetera. So it would not have been as definitive as, say, a medical examiner who actually did the autopsy themselves, because she's a little limited in the conclusions she can draw since she was not present.
Now, it's difficult for me to wrap my brain around the autopsy testimony problem. People die, medical examiners die, so the fact that the autopsy of a case that's been cold for 47 years can't be admitted into evidence simply because this person is no longer around seems like a flaw in the system. It certainly doesn't feel fair. But as Emily explained to us, there are other compounding factors that made this expert witness's testimony difficult.
She has Dr. Gwotes' report, and then she has the photos. And, the photos, I know, obviously, the photos that were taken before the autopsy were put in before she would have been called. I know they've seemed like a lot. Compared to the number of photos that we would have in a modern autopsy, they were very minimal. In an autopsy now, an autopsy done in 2021, we would have photos like the ones we saw, and then very up close, sort of high definition photos of the actual internal structures of the body. And those are used to show things like, say, internal hemorrhaging type areas, if there's broken bones, damage to cartilage. And those can be especially important in cases where strangulation or asphyxia are suspected. And so, things dealing with petechia along the eyes, congestion of the blood in the throat that can only be seen really internally because maybe a bruise hadn't developed, things like that. Those types of photos we would have just tons of. And it seems like back then there weren't really photos taken during the actual autopsy itself. It was more about documentation of the outside of the body. So she's really more of a medical expert who's able to explain some things as far as like what was seen in the structure, the actual structure of the throat, the physical structure, things like that.
The state's final witness this third day was going to be Carla Walker's brother, Jim.
We were going to have Mr. Walker talk with the jury about that night. We kind of heard some of that in his allocution, you know, what he remembers of Rodney coming to the home that night. And then from a more factual perspective, not as much in kind of the emotional perspective that he gave it in the interview or in the allocution, his testimony would have been a lot about, you know, how he has, you know, carried on in getting this case investigated and what all that involved, since he's a civilian who had to go through many, many iterations of detectives and kind of wrap up the case that way. We were ready to have them there. I mean, they were there that morning. We were ready to have them testify that morning, and things changed very suddenly. But that was really the remaining part of our case. I think it probably would have wrapped up later on that day, just based on timing anyways, but obviously changed very quickly that morning.
The testimony most damning against McCurley, however, had already taken place the first and second days of trial, and perhaps was the reason for the confessed killer's change of plea. Both of Carla's siblings, Jim and Cindy, certainly thought so.
You know, I left the courtroom on Monday thinking to myself, what possible defense could his defense counsel bring to bear at that courtroom? None. Nobody was going to testify for him. There were no witnesses for the defense that were going to counter this technology. I mean, after you listen to Trey from Authorn Lab on the stand and Mallory, forthright, detailed, there was no debating. He was the guy. How do you counter his sperm being on her bra inside of her cup? And seeing the interrogation tape, everything came to a screeching halt. And that afternoon, I believe that the defense counsel took him back into whatever room they went in off the courtroom. They had a conversation. And I believe the defense counsel said, look, here's the way it's going to roll tomorrow. You're going to have the KRLD interview. Again, reiterating the original interrogation with Detective Wagner and Detective Bennett. You're going to have the coroner who's going to, in graphic details, tell about how you crushed her throat and how you hit her in the face, bruising around the face, neck, cuts on her body. And then you're going to have her brother most likely talking about how this affected his family and his life. He's only 12 years old. You have no defense, and it won't hurt to go ahead and plead guilty to save your family, your wife and your son, any more heartbreak about what you did to this little girl. You're going to get the same sentence as you will from the jury. Let's just cut this thing off because that's the way it's going to go. I have to believe that's the conversation they had. I believe the defense counsel would have still presented as good as a defense in that last day as he could possibly do. But I think McCurley listened to some wisdom, and glad he did. I don't know the details of that conversation, but I'm glad he did. And it was not a surprise to me that they had reached, you know, a guilty plea.
The defense didn't have much to give up a fight on, you know, that was of any value, really. I mean, very little cross-examination. And what they did cross-examine to me was, you know, just piddly, I mean, to me. I think they had to do their job, but it was nothing that would have broke the case. So I think we just had a solid case. So, and I think once that confession hit and the jurors saw that, I don't know what else you could really say, you know, or do. And I think the DNA was the clincher. I mean, that did it. How could you argue with that? We knew about the gun. We knew that they had gotten the gun. So to me, that was icing on the cake. I mean, I don't know what else could have been presented to make it even a more solid case. I asked Jeff Bennett that day, I said, Jeff, did he change his plea on his own or did his attorneys convince him that's what he need do? And he goes, you know, I don't know really.
Nicole, or juror number 6, also told me it would have been hard for the defense to provide reasonable doubt. The evidence already presented, she said, was just about as damning as it gets.
The defense didn't really talk a whole lot. I think they did a good job with all that they could do, but they didn't ever cause me to doubt his guilt at all. We all ended on Monday like, okay, seriously, like, what are they going to tell us tomorrow? Because there's really nothing else.
When the courtroom finally settled down, and the initial shock of Glenn McCurley's plea change and sentencing waned some, Cindy Walker Stone took the stand to address her sister's killer face to face.
I wish you had done this a long time ago. I spent 17 years in the same bedroom with my sister. I knew her. She was 4'11", 100 pounds. You had choices, lots of choices that night. You went out to kill somebody. You had your gun, you had your alcohol, you had your whiskey. And you're still not telling the truth about everything you did, because you did beat her. She had bruises that didn't happen by just bumping into a car door. And you know that you raped her, and you strangled her, and dumped her in a culvert. She didn't deserve that. You had so many choices that night. You didn't have to kill her. You did not have to kill her. And you kept saying in your confession that that just wasn't you, that's just not you. It was. That's you. That's what you did. You have no remorse. You had no remorse for her family, for any of us, for Rodney. I don't feel sorry for you. You did the right thing by pleading guilty, but it should have happened a long time ago. That night, you're not telling the truth of everything. I don't want to know everything, but I want to know. If you've done this to anybody else, you need to bring that out, because those families need to know too. You have nothing to lose at this point, because it's been hell. And so you got to live for 47 years and do all this stuff. And we went through this for 47 years. We never gave up. I got married 3 months after Carla died. She was to be my maid of honor. You lived right down the street from us, practically. How many times did you pass our house? I know you did. How many times did you walk over that marker in Western Hills High School in the floor that her class donated? You say it's not you, but it is. And what you've done now, Mr. McCurley, is taken all the pain and everything we went through and put it on your family now until the day they die. Because they're going to live with this too. They're going to live with this for the rest of their life. Your son, your wife, your grandchildren, your brothers, sister-in-laws, uncles, whoever you have. And so anything that you thought you did good these past 47 years is wiped out, because that's not what they're going to remember. The legacy you've left them is the pain. And that you're a murderer. You're a kidnapper, a rapist, and a murderer. And that's what they're going to have to live with. And I see the pain in your son's eyes every time we come to trial. You just don't have any idea what you've done to so many people. And for what reason, I don't know. But it was you. You went out intentionally to rape somebody and kill them. And you You did my sister. She was 100 pounds. You know that. Her dress didn't look like she didn't fight you. It looks like she did. Cuts on her knees, bruises on her. She fought you. She struggled, and you know that. And if you ever want to confess to me through a letter, I don't care what you did. I'll listen. But I loved my sister dearly. It's a big hole in my heart. I had already lost an older sister, so she was all I had left as far as the girls. And you took that away. And I think you know what it's like to lose a loved one. So I just ask you, if you have done this to anybody else, confess, because you have nothing to lose and you have no idea what you're doing to the families and your family. And it needs to end now. Rodney was a victim of this. You've ruined his life. He was an excellent boyfriend. We spent over a year all together, my boyfriend, Rodney, Carla, up in our bedroom. They never fought, never once. They argued, but they didn't fight. He was an absolutely great boyfriend. So many things you're saying I know is a lie, because I knew her character. I knew Rodney's character. You just have to tell the truth, because it's a lie. There was no way he'd be hitting her. It just didn't happen. So until you, to you yourself, come to being honest with yourself, you know what it is. And if I had the choice to give you your sentence, it would be strangulation and dumped in a culvert. But since I don't, we don't want the death penalty for you, because that's too easy, because you'd be on death row forever until you die by yourself. But I hope you step into prison, and the first day you step in there is the best day of your life in there. And every day after that, you pay. And to me, it's not cruel. It's justice. Justice for Carla.
Cindy's eyes were locked with McCurley's the entire time. It was, and my words under-exaggerate my feelings, one of the most incredible and emotional shows of strength that I've ever seen. Everyone was touched in a big way by Cindy's allocation, from Detectives Leah Wagner and Jeff Bennett.
I was proud of her. She did a great job.
To her brother, Jim.
I love what my sister Cindy said is, I hope your first day in prison is the best day for the rest of your life. Wasn't that beautiful? She was representing for my mom and my dad, of course, and my parents would have been so proud of her. She was a warrior on that stand, and a warrior, but did not allow McCurley to cause her to break down and just shattered. I mean, she was looking at McCurley like a Patriot missile locked onto a target. Man, I'm so proud of my sister.
Jim Walker has a degenerative eye disease and is legally blind. So when it came time to give his allocation, he asked to stand in front of his sister's killer so he could make out the man. Because of this, audio cut out, and folks viewing the live stream, those not in the courtroom, didn't get to hear his allocation. I can promise you that, like Cindy's statement, Jim's was powerful. He told me the main points he was trying to get across to the confessed killer.
I told him, I said, your life is over. Your life is over. With respect to what I said, I asked God not to let me cry. And one time I know I got a little choked up, and I hope McCurley heard me when I told him. I said, don't misunderstand these tears. They're not tears of sadness. They're tears of anger because I can't do to you what I wanted to do to you. And I no longer want to do that. But since probably 16, 17, 18, when I really realized everything that had gone on and I saw some things that showed heavy bruising to Carla's face on her left side, I just something came over me and seeing what was going on with my mom. So I wanted to express to him, I had great parents. I had strong parents. I wanted him to know that he created an army that came after him, and they're sitting in the courtroom. They're watching, you know, you victimized your family. And I wanted to make sure that he knew without yelling or screaming that we're still standing. You're not. What you intended for evil is turning out to be good. And I wanted him to hear me loud and clear that prison is not going to go well for him. Doesn't matter. He's just an old fat white guy, which I don't buy that he's sick as he says he is. Guys in prison, I mean, they have access to the internet, Google, YouTube. They're going to know everything about him, and it's not going to go well for him. They don't like guys like him in prison. And that's the reason I was encouraging him to, I know he's done this to other people, maybe murder, but definitely rape. I believe that without hesitation, because that's the type of weak man that he is. And not even a man, he's a boy in a man's body. But just confessing to Carla's crime, if you're culpable in other horrendous crimes, rape is a horrendous crime. Kidnapping is a horrendous crime. Murder is a horrendous crime. If you're guilty of those, you know, you're not making it to heaven. And I believe that you're, once you enter Texas Department of Criminal Justice for the rest of your natural life, you're just getting a small, small, small taste of hell. I don't know if it went in one ear or out the other, because I'm sure there's not a lot between the ears to stop it, but gives closure to other Carter Walkers. It's not going to make a difference. Everybody knows who and what he is, but he has a chance to change the rest of his life on this earth. But as I told him, I hope he takes advantage of it by bringing healing to other families. Nothing's going to change in his future. Doesn't matter where he goes or not. His truck routes, if he's done this on his truck routes, which I believe he has, he's done this right here in the city of Fort Worth. I truly believe he has. He's not going to get the death penalty. He's going to stay in prison, but these families deserve to know. And I hope that he brings some healing to other families. And his family already knows what he is, and they already have suspicions. I absolutely believe that. Nobody's told me that, but my gut tells me that they do.
Though I was almost overcome with emotion to the point of debilitation during Cindy and Jim's allocations, I was also frantically writing notes. In his statement at court, Jim described to McCurley staying up late the night Carla was abducted. The Walkers had family in from out of town, and everyone was happy and having a good time, until Jim heard a car screech to a halt in front of the home. It was Rodney, bloodied, dazed, and in a panic from the attack on him and Carla. It was the first time, Jim told McCurley, he'd ever seen death or true fear. That's the moment when, he recalled, his life changed forever. He told McCurley he was going to call him Sammy, a little boy's name, since the killer was hardly a man. Jim described the chaos of everyone springing into action, cleaning the blood off of Rodney with a washcloth, and his father grabbing his pistol and speeding up to the Ridgely Brunswick bowling alley, the site of the abduction. "I wish he'd have found you that night," Jim said. "He'd have dispatched you." Jim, too, spent much of the past 47 years wanting to kill whoever murdered his sister, and even had a place picked out to do it, should he ever have had the opportunity. Jim told McCurley this place was out in the middle of nowhere, where no one would hear him screaming. And in fact, Jim continued, he'd have encouraged the man to scream. The date McCurley began his sick game of predator and prey, February 16, 1974, had significance in the man's life. In his allocation, Jim confronted his sister's killer with that.
And I hope the courtroom heard me say that he started hunting on his 11th wedding anniversary when his wife and kids were out of town. I hope they heard that, because does that not paint the type of demonic spirit that resides inside Glenn McCurley? Somebody doesn't just do that in one time. There's a thrill about it. I got away. I got a little girl. There's a thrill of, I was the man, I was in charge. The only time he's ever been in charge of anything.
"You're Satan," Jim told McCurley. Like Carla, the killer's son attended Western Hills High School. When he died after his car was struck by a drunk driver in 1988, McCurley's son was buried at the Greenwood Memorial Park Cemetery. His grave only a 30-second walk from the grave of Carla Walker. He knew Glenn McCurley chose that plot on purpose, Jim said. Jim and Cindy both have wondered this, thinking of the white carnations the family would sometimes find on Carla's headstone, placed there by someone unknown. "You'll never see your son again," Jim told McCurley, referring to the man spending eternity in hell. "I will. I wipe off his headstone and pray for him when I go visit my sister." Just after that, Jim looked toward the area where Glenn McCurley's other son sat. He whispered, "It's not your fault." Jim told McCurley that he had dishonored his surviving boy. In Rodney McCoy's initial recollection, if I'm not mistaken, he described Carla's kidnapper as saying, "You're coming with me, aren't you, sweetie?" Aware that McCurley calls his wife sweetie, Jim wondered now how that made her feel, he told the man, or little boy, as Jim likes to refer to him as. He told McCurley about the army who had gathered to keep alive and solve Carla's case. "I know you heard them marching," Jim said, "coming for you." Jim went on to tell Glenn McCurley about the rage he had felt in the past, that he'd bought his childhood home in hopes his sister's killer would come there and confess, but that McCurley no longer owned his rage and anger. "I forgive you," Jim concluded. "Good luck, Mr. McCurley." Since Rodney McCoy had testified and couldn't sit in on the trial as a result, and since he had no way to know that Glenn Samuel McCurley would change his plea and end the trial abruptly, he didn't make it to the courthouse in time to deliver his allocation. Like Detectives Wagner and Bennett, Jim and Cindy both thought that Glenn McCurley's tears during his police confession were genuine. But they weren't the result of remorse for what he'd done to their sister.
"He's always been a coward. He's always been a boy, and he got a bigger body and didn't know what to do with it. But he's always thought as a, been thinking as a boy. And, you know, that was evident in the interrogation where he said, you know, crying like a little boy, reminded me of a little punk boy. I was scared she was going to tell on me. You know, that's not a man. That's a boy." Those are tears of "I'm caught," not tears of "I did something horrible." And he's crying because he knows his goose is cooked.
Juror number 6, Nicole, agreed.
"Oh no, not remorse for Carla. He was sad because he got caught." Those tears were genuine, but they were genuine tears of "they know it was me."
While Glenn Samuel McCurley was finally brought to justice and now begins his accountability for this heinous act, the Walkers and Rodney McCoy are healing.
"A lot of praying, a lot of sleeping, a lot of loving. I'm at peace. It just took a little bit, had to breathe, took a little bit to cycle through. A lot of thankfulness, a lot of sadness, memories fly through your mind. We have done as a community what we promised Carla. I promised my mom. I remember I used to put her to bed at nighttime and kiss her on her cheek and whisper in her ear and say, we're going to get them. And the thing I'm sad about is I used to tell her, we're going to get them. You're going to see. We're going to get them, meaning that she was going to be here. And, of course, that didn't come to fruition, but we got them. We did what we set out to do as a community. A gladiator's effort has been put into this. Carla's story won't go away. It'll be passed down for many more generations. Nothing worth doing is ever easy. And this most certainly was not an easy task. But Carla, she went out swinging too. She went out swinging. She's not a victim. She's a victor."
"Once he got arrested, you know, I told you it took me a while to even accept that it was really happening. And it's like, okay, something, you know, nothing's going to go wrong. They really got this guy. And then you lead up to the trial, and it moves so fast. And it was like, whoa, okay. Wow. He's really been caught. You know, it's just kind of hitting me slow. Even after all these years, the impact that it had on detectives, you know, Mentor, and I know, like, if George Hudson, if he was still alive, it was, it just impacted the whole community. I don't know why exactly, except that it was such a big case, and just, I don't know, I just think Carla, you know, a high school kid going to her Valentine's dance, you know, it's like I told somebody, I said, you know, the thing was, Carla didn't have a dark side. She wasn't mean. She was just an average 17-year-old in high school. Through the years, I would get people on Facebook who would message me that I didn't even know and say, if you're not Cindy Walker, Carla's sister, I'm sorry, but I just want to let you know, I've got teenage girls now, and I keep thinking about when Carla was taken and how I've treated my girls with what they do. So people, it's just been passed down through the generations.
When we first started reaching out to folks while researching Carla's case in 2017, no one could get a hold of Rodney. Since my best friend lives in Austin, not far from the town and address we had for the man, he hand-delivered a letter to Rodney from us. I was on the phone with him shortly thereafter. I've noticed a major change in Rodney McCoy from when we first spoke on the phone to when we saw him in Austin this past June and while spending time with him during the trial. After McCurley's plea change, I accompanied Carla's best friend Connie, Rodney McCoy, Rodney's sister Len, and his and our close friend Kathleen for a couple beers at the Ridgely Country Club. Everyone was reeling from the unexpected events that took place earlier that day. As Connie and Rodney reminisced about Carla and old times at Western Hills High, a sweaty guy who'd obviously been working out approached. "Rodney?" he asked. Rodney replied yes, and the man proceeded to tell him he'd been following the trial. He was a former Dallas County District Attorney, the man said, and in his 20 years of service, he'd never seen a defendant in a murder case change their plea mid-trial. After having a few beers, Rodney and company met Jim, Cindy, and others at the Westside Cafe. I wish I'd gone, but I didn't, because I wanted to allow the family some time to themselves. At this lunch, Detectives Leah Wagner and Jeff Bennett presented Rodney with something special. The promise ring he gave to Carla almost 5 decades ago. Here's the detectives.
Well, you know, when they were together, he came from a family that didn't have much, you know, single mom and no money. So I imagine he was probably working pretty hard just trying to make enough to go hang out with his girlfriend and take her out on dates. So for him to buy her a promise ring probably sucked up most of what he had.
Absolutely.
You know, and then that night started out with him giving her that promise ring before the dance. So we told him that we wanted to give him back a piece of Carla. And that was what we had.
Well, I have to recognize that Leah was the one that thought of that. And then
there's no Leah and team, Jeff. It's just we.
I know. But I concurred with her that I felt like that was something we absolutely needed to do. And, you know, we were very fortunate that when we got authorization to pull that ring out of property to give that back to Rodney, that was a huge moment for us.
You know what, though? I think one of the best things coming out of this is that Rodney gets to live again.
Yes.
He has a little bit of a pep in his step now. He gained some weight. When we saw him on Friday, the first day of the trial, I told him, I said, wow.
You look so good.
You look really good. And he said, I feel good.
From when we interviewed him in 2019 to now, just a world of difference. And it was great to see that peace on his face and that relief.
Well, and he had survivor's guilt as well because, you know, he wasn't able to protect her and why her and not me. You know, but his daughter had told us thank you, that she definitely saw the changes in her dad and that it was definitely for the better. And that, you know, she says he seems so much happier now.
Rodney McCoy, he told me, had put down $20 on that ring and had to make payments. In another incredible occurrence, after a photo of the ring was posted on social media, Rodney's good buddy, Buzz, discovered that he had bought the exact same promise ring for his then-girlfriend, Melinda, around the same time. None of them ever knew that before. Both Cindy and Jim told me how different a person Rodney is after 47 years dealing with Carla's abduction and murder.
And Rodney, I am so happy to see him smile now and actually laugh. And like he said, you know, for all those years, he was always, you know, under that umbrella of suspicion, always, which makes sense, and he understood, but it's just this big weight off of his shoulder, knowing, you know, that they've got the guy. And I knew all along it wasn't Rodney, and I knew all along it wasn't anybody that she knew or he knew. I always thought a random thing, and it was some psychopath. But Rodney feels so much better, and he's so happy, and that this guy's caught, and he just feels just a relief, you know, because we always forgot, but that Rodney was as much a victim for all these years too, because people always thought, how can a quarterback not do this and that? But I've never had a gun stuck in my face and clicked 3 times. So what can I say about that? I've never done that. And that he was the last person to hear Carla speak and be taken away. Gosh, you know, that's something that would keep coming back in your mind. I know that's why he never moved back to Fort Worth and didn't want to come back to Fort Worth, because the memories were hard for him. They were just too hard. He said every time he walked into our house after that happened and he saw that big picture of Carla on the wall, pictures of her here and there, he said it was like this weight on him, because he felt like he had let my dad down. And just the memories, you know, and he said it was just so hard. And I said, well, I understand, Rodney. We never held anything against you. We all understood. I never slept back upstairs by myself after Carla died. I had my clothes up there, but I slept downstairs the rest of the time until I moved out. But I'm happy for Rodney. I'm sad it's taken so long and he's 65, but I know it took a toll on relationships that he had. So I think it's all going to work out good, and it's more peaceful now.
Whenever I speak with Jim and Cindy, the bulk of our conversations are anecdotal and light. We always talk about Carla's case, of course, but generally we spend most of the time sharing stories of our family life. Cindy's stories about her grandkids, by the way, are some of the best I've ever heard. Anyway, one thing I noticed about our most recent conversations is that Cindy and Jim are laughing a lot more. It's clear that a heavy weight has been lifted from them both. But still, the impact of Carla's violent murder, the resulting pain, is always there, waiting to surface at any given moment.
In the trial, when I told Kim, I do not want to see graphic stuff and I don't want to hear about it. And that's when she always told me, okay, the next witness is coming up, and this is what they're going to show and talk about. So I would leave the courtroom, because I just didn't want to remember Carla like that, you know, because I can remember her leaving that night. We shared a room and stuff. So I just want to remember the good times, the fun times, how happy she was. Do I look good in this dress? Is it too long? Is it too short? Is it too tight? You know, things like that. And I don't want to see the grueling part. And then when I came back in, the family said, it's a good thing you walked out. So, you know, it's like I told somebody, I said, you know, the thing was, Carla didn't have a dark side. She wasn't mean. She was just an average 17-year-old in high school, you know, who loved her boyfriend and had fun doing all the high school stuff. There was nothing bad about her. She was just a good high school girl. And that's what, to me, is really sad as well. No one deserves to die like that, no matter what they are, but she just was happy. The poor little thing. She just didn't deserve that at all, at all. And she really was a sweetie. I'm just saying, she was. She just smiled all the time, and I don't know. It's just crazy. So I remember the good times. I remember all the good times that we all had. And like Rodney said, yeah, I was supposed to be studying upstairs with y'all, but he goes, very little studying got done. I said, I know that, but it sounds good, doesn't it? I said, you brought your books. Yeah, he laughed. He says, you know, there were six of us up there because my girlfriend lived with me the last of our senior year, and her boyfriend was there. And my boyfriend was there, and we just laugh and have a good time, and just, I don't know what we did, but I think we smoked cigarettes out through on the balcony or out the window. I don't know what we did, but we had a good time. It was fun, and, you know, he said, yeah, we didn't get much studying done, Cindy. Okay. Well, that's not the story I'm telling, Rodney. You were studying.
You know, and the thing is, just listening testimony, Carla, she was just a teenage, 17-year-old teenage girl, had a good spirit, honorary as could be. She was just a normal, all-American teenage girl who loved her family, loved her friends, not unlike the daughters of other moms and dads out there. And like every death for things like this, Vince, you know, you think, what if, what could have been? And it's not going to be, but it sure makes you appreciate the time you had. And losing Carla, would she ever created a cure for cancer? I don't know. Would she ever been a nuclear physicist for a space rocket to Pluto? I don't know. Would she just been a wonderful wife, sister, mom, friend? Definitely. Would she have worked hard and impacted her community with her infectious smile? Yes. You know, we missed her touching a little bit of our community, and that's deeply missed. But I want people to remember she was just like your daughter, just like your son. She was just an average all-American girl who left a huge, huge fingerprint on her community and people that she loved. And she's greatly missed. And it took me a while and I suspect Cindy feels this even stronger than I do. But, you know, I missed the opportunity to have been an uncle to her kids. I missed the opportunity to have nieces and nephews at Christmas and Thanksgiving, Easter and holiday events at our house that I'm sitting in right now. I missed the opportunity to hold her and tell her I love her when things weren't going good in life. All those things that as families we do for each other. I missed the opportunity to laugh and celebrate and cry with my sister. It did fracture part of our fabric. I would be lying if I said, you know, we just walked through this unscathed. That's not true. But, you know, what family doesn't have some scabbing, right? We got through this. And I know I've never been to a funeral where they said, oh, well, we'll see him in, you know, we'll see him in hell. It's every funeral I've ever gone to said, we're going to see him or her in heaven. Well, with Carla, I can say we are going to see her in heaven. I know she's there. McCurley, not so much.
As I spoke with Jim, I tried to imagine how he felt at that moment, talking to me about Carla in the same house he'd grown up next to her in.
As I'm sitting here right now, I can see Carla coming in the side door over there, her hair pulled back in a ponytail. You know, I don't know how the girls describe it, but those little bangs kind of, that just weren't long enough to pull back in a ponytail, kind of coming down. Her walking really fast, bebopping, looking around. And Rodney talked about being late for the Valentine's dance, and he got the look. Oh, I know that look. When Carla gave you the look, you thought, uh-oh. I mean, I was 12. You know, I was kind of the bratty little brother. I don't think I was so much, but that's what Finney tells me I was. I just remember Carla. Yeah, I remember her being a force to be. I don't remember her being anything but fun and smiling when you're a teenager, and me watching her. And as I got older, I realized the feelings I was thinking about my sister were just how beautiful she was and how happy and bebopping. And just, I'm thankful for the short time I had with her. I missed the times that I've missed with her, but I know I'll get to see her on the other side, and I'm looking forward to that.
The pain the Walkers have endured throughout these 47 years remains, but is eased. For the McCurley family, however, a similar feeling of loss and confusion has just begun.
I had a chance to meet several close members of McCurley, family members, and his son. I don't know his son other than the brief time we've been together, but there's a hurt in him that I understand. Glenn McCurley so dishonored and victimized his very own boy and his grandchildren by this action. And there is zero anger or accountability to his son from the Walker family. We held each other right cheek to right cheek. And, you know, it was easy for me to do it because we've lived this for 46 years, 47 years. I felt his pain as I felt the pain of my family on the day that they announced Carla was found dead. So, but we've had four and a half decades to process it, let the dust settle, go from anger and rage, which is always there, to determination. His son is at the very front of that process that we started 47 years ago. I told his son, it's not your fault. He's your dad. Don't own this. This is not you. But there's a healing process that people have to go through, right? But McCurley's clearly victimized much, much more than just Carla. He victimized his own family, and they should not have any shame or disgrace or anything hanging over them. That's not their fault.
He is genuinely a nice man. He has been just really comforting to me, and I think our family. Here he is in so much pain, as we are, but he has just gone out of his way to comfort us during the trial, too. So he's just amazing. He's been very, very, him and his aunt and uncle, they always came up to me after breaks telling me that they're here for Carla and not for him. And yeah, I just think it's amazing that people can be like that.
Carla Walker's legacy has changed. No longer is her case associated with uncertainty and a faceless boogeyman. Rather, Carla is now a symbol of hope for the countless family members of victims whose cases have gone cold.
Carla's case has been resolved. Now we're swinging our focus to helping the next Carla Walker family. And, you know, with one thing that God has put on my heart is he's painted a fabric. He's painted a template on how to get things done. And my message to other families is, especially in cold case murders, you have to get to a point in your psyche, your spirit, that you realize you're not in a sprint, you're in a marathon. You have to keep running. I hope to use Carla's case as a template for other people. I believe we've got a template here for families like Carla's, our family, that we can provide direction with the understanding that their case is going to be uniquely different in areas than Carla's case. But you have to adapt as you go. But it's so incredibly important to build coalitions, not build warring factions, with law enforcement, with the media, with, you know, the community. And I think a lot of families out there are just overwhelmed. What do I do? Well, there's a template there, and it might only start with one or two, three people, but I'm telling you, there's people out there who might not know you who will come aside with you and work with you and get the word out. Build that relationship with law enforcement, build that relationship with media, build that relationship with just people in the community. They'll come aside you because there's more good people out there than there are bad. None of us tolerate evil. Bad things happen when good men do nothing. So that's what I hope is going to come out of this resolution for Carla, is that we can provide a template on to conversation, encouraging, relationship building. Don't give up. It might not be. This might be 10 years old. It might not be in the next year. It might be another 10 or 15 years, but you have to stay the course.
As far as Glenn Samuel McCurley is concerned, justice for other victims is potentially on the horizon.
You know, I told my friend, I said, so all these years, what I've concentrated on and always thought about was what Carla went through, what he did to her, what she endured, what all happened, just Carla. And I never thought too much about him, except we want to catch this person, until we actually had the arrest. And then it was like, okay, now I want to know about him. What made him do this? And there wasn't a reason, I don't think, except that he's just a sociopath. And, you know, it was like I told him, I said, that's your legacy now, buddy. Kidnapper, rapist, and murderer. That's what people are going to remember for the rest of their life. If you impacted their life in any way, that's what they're going to remember. You know, that's the pain that everybody in his family is going to have to live with now. This old man is just as we refer to him, the killer. He was the bad man, but now he's the killer. And that's how we refer to him, as the killer.
Because of McCurley's refusal to tell the truth about how, why, and where he beat, raped, and killed Carla Walker, many questions remain unanswered. Cindy plans on corresponding with her sister's killer through a legally sanctioned remediation type of program and hopes he'll eventually own up to everything he's done. More importantly, though, she and Jim both told us, they hope the man will come clean about his role in other monstrous crimes, so that other families can finally have answers, the relief that comes with them, and perhaps justice.
I think he himself emotionally just got off that he went all these years without getting caught, you know, on Carla's case. And if hers was the first, or if there were some before, these people, if they don't know their victim and the victim doesn't know them, it's more of getting away with it. And, you know, so there's DNA on any of these other ones, because obviously he wasn't very safe. I think they could solve some more. So I look forward to that. So if the guy has any remorse, he's in prison the rest of his life. He's not going to get out. He might as well just clear it up. But he's such a liar that I don't know if he will, who knows?
There's too many unsolved cases that we're all aware of that are too similar. Those families deserve closure and answers.
We know of a few violent murders in particular that took place in the month of February in various years, cases we think McCurley could have perpetrated. Becky, June, and Christy. That's next time on Gone Cold.
Everything just fell into place like a puzzle. It just came together smoothly, and we got the conviction. It was almost too easy if you think about it. Everyone worked so hard to get it there, and we got him while he was still alive. And I think it was meant to be. It was time.
Carla Walker's murder is solved. But the city of Fort Worth still has nearly 1,000 cold cases dating back to 1959. If you have any information about any unsolved case in the city of Fort Worth, please contact the Cold Case Unit at 817-392-4307. Or you can email detectives at coldcase@fortworthpd.com. If you'd like to help find answers for the families of victims, or even help identify a Jane or John Doe, please visit DNA Solves, where you can submit your DNA data from a consumer testing company, like Ancestry, for example, to their database. If you have not tested with one of these consumer sources, but would like to help law enforcement identify violent criminals and Jane or John Does, you can go to connect.dnasolves.com to order a cheek swab kit directly from them for only $15. Your DNA profile on dnasolves.com will only be used for law enforcement investigations. You can even be part of solving a cold case there by donating a little cash to one or all of the law enforcement cases there that need help funding. We'll provide links to dnasolves.com, connect.dnasolves.com, and the Fort Worth Cold Case Unit in this episode's show notes. We'd like to thank Cindy, Jim, Tarrant County ADA Emily Dixon, Juror Number 6 Nicole, and Fort Worth Homicide Cold Case Detectives Leah Wagner and Jeff Bennett for their contributions to this episode. Thanks to all Carla's friends and classmates and our listeners for keeping Carla Walker's memory alive and seeking justice for her. As always, you can support Gone Cold at patreon.com/GoneColdPodcast. Thanks to everyone who supports us there. We appreciate y'all's support beyond words. Thanks for listening, y'all.